I can hear you guys all right, so I think we're all set.
Okay, let's go.
Talking landscape photography with Kristen Fletcher and Cowan.
It is another exciting episode of Light Minded with myself and Cristiano Fletcher. And we've got a special guest on today too. But Fletcher, before we get into it, mate, I had a chat with the guy from Panasonic a week or so ago. And I took his call and I thought, oh, geez, I'm going to want my S1R back. But... mate, this is just a rumor at this stage, but they've suggested that through this podcast that we might be able to give away a Panasonic S1R.
Ah, really? Through the podcast?
Yeah, a Lumix S1R.
Oh, wow. Cool. Yep. Excellent. And are we able to receive that as well, or is it just going to go to one of our customers?
It has to go to one of the listeners. So it, I think it's just rumor stage. So in the next couple of weeks or so, we're going to roll out some hard sort of information on it. But I believe it's going to be just constrained to the Australian audience. So if you, if you're one of our listeners in Kazakhstan, my sister, she is number two prostitute in all the... Anyway, so, look, stay tuned for that one. And also, mate, look, I don't know if you remember, but I think it was last week we asked if anybody knew what art was. Do you remember that, Fledge?
Oh, yeah, did someone get the answer for us?
No.
Okay. No, well, just Dave might be able to tell us.
Just check the
emails.
What's
the question?
Well, what is art?
What is art?
Yeah.
Good question. Yeah. It's just a bunch of crazy shit you make up in your head and then build it in real life.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yep.
Yeah. Have we introduced Dave yet, Carmen?
Oh, no, we haven't even bothered. the guest we've got on the show today is what I would describe as a hardcore, proper landscape photographer. He gave up his social media following of over 1.5 million people to spend 9 months of his year basically living out of his four-wheel drive and taking photos. Dave Morrow, welcome to Light Minded. Why?
Well, first off, thanks for having me, guys. It's good to be here.
Pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure.
Why? Well, I just found myself kind of, I don't know, there's like a background program always running in my brain when I was on social media all the time. So maybe you post a photo on there and people comment, and then you have some good conversations, you have some annoying conversations. But I felt like after I would shut it off for the day, I couldn't shut that conversation off that I was having. Like, little things would pop into my head.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this doesn't happen to everybody. Maybe it's just my own weird brain that this was happening in. But I felt like all those little background loops running in my brain were taking away from my ability to think clearly and work on things that really mattered to me. Mm-hmm. So I'm an all or nothing kind of person. Mm-hmm. So it was either do it or don't do it. So I just shut it off to see what would happen. Mm-hmm. And it's been great ever since. I've been more prolific than I ever have in my life. Mm-hmm. And I felt more rewarded by photography than I ever have.
Okay. So how long ago did you do that?
It's probably been about 2.5 years. Now, I still have YouTube. So a lot of people consider that social media.
Yeah.
I just consider it like a knowledge database or a video repository where you can show trips and stuff. Because
it's so interesting. You know, when we get people on to the podcast, everyone has something to offer that gives, I mean, even Carmen and I, we get so much from our guests all the time. And then when I started doing some research on you and your work, I came across the one, there was a post there on social media and the hidden costs of social media. Mm. And it's so weird that Jen and I, my wife and I, we've got our gallery down here in Dunsborough. We've been, you know, I've been doing photography for 31 years and had a successful, you know, career doing that. But we're at this point where we hate Facebook and we just want to know how the hell did we get off and what are our alternatives. And then all of a sudden I'm reading this and you're talking about the things that you don't think about, what it's costing you to be on social media, and the cost is your creativity and time and how much you're wasting. So, yeah, thanks for you know, opening my eyes and helping me see that it possibly can be done, that we can extract ourselves, because obviously we were doing other things before Facebook came along and other things like Twitter and all that. So, yeah, so what? How do you manage to keep the following? Is obviously YouTube is one thing, but you mentioned, I think when I was reading something about you mentioned that websites and doing good work, and people will come to you. I mean, they find you because of the work that you produce. Is that how it's worked for you?
Yeah, it definitely worked well for me. Now, I mean, first off, I don't think that everything about social media is bad. I think it can be a great tool for a lot of people. In my case, I didn't find it to have benefits. Like if I weighed the pros and cons, the cons were a lot more. But I did also have a website that was doing fairly well as far as traffic before I quit social media. I wouldn't really attribute all that traffic to social, because once I stopped it, the traffic still kept going. So I've always based my business around writing really what I consider to be good articles at the time, and continuing to build photo portfolio articles and knowledge resources on my website. And the thing about this is, if you build really good content on your own website, people will share it on social media for you. You don't really need the presence, right? If you have a really good website, people will just click the share button. I still have them all over my website. If you want to share an article, you can click share on Facebook, right? So a lot of people still tell me, Dave, I found you from social media, from somebody sharing your posts. So it's not like you lose out on all of that aspect when you quit. You just don't have to put the constant churn in to keep creating content in that way. Now, for people that like being on social, great, go do it. I mean, I'm not against it at all. It just wasn't something that I found to be a rewarding experience for me that helped my business at the same time.
Now, that's interesting, because it is the you know, photography, you either do it for yourself, or you do it as a hobby, or you do it because you love it. And then there's also the business side of it, where you know, if you love it and you want to do that full time, how do you make a living from it so that you don't have to go do some other horrible job in the meantime? So you've managed to do that. And how do you derive most of your income from photography?
Almost all of my income comes from an online platform I have. So I built my own online landscape photography school. It's just called the Landscape Photography School. And it's, you can think of it like a Netflix for learning every aspect of landscape photography. So from shooting technique, camera technique, to photo editing, to backpacking, outdoor gear, everything that encompasses the whole thing. I'm basically slowly over time building all my knowledge onto there as like a knowledge repository that people can sign up and just learn from, and kind of bypass all the mistakes that I've made along the way, and hopefully start to get some rewards in a shorter amount of time that I got. And I also do talks and stuff on there that tries to teach the mindset and the psychology of, you don't always have to be tapped into constant social media, constant churning of having ratings on your photos. You can get a really rewarding experience without all that. It's just going to take some time to get used to it, because it's a much different experience. So that's where I devote all my time, to teaching people on there. It's fully interactive. They get videos. They can ask me questions. I do like live sessions on there. But I've, like I was saying, I'm off or on. I can only do one thing. I've devoted all my time to just making that my income stream.
Dave, you've got a very clear instructional style, because I've checked out your stuff, and it's not full of fluff. It's straight to the point. And, you know, I'm watching some of your stuff, you know, on Lightroom going, well, I didn't actually really even know that myself. Did you have a background in teaching? Like, how did you develop that that clear style?
Thank you. I appreciate it. Well, I can tell you that it definitely wasn't always like that. It used to be really bad. Even if I look back like 5 years, it's not as clear. I got lucky that I was an aerospace engineer for my former job. It just so happened that when I was an aerospace engineer, my job was doing technical writing. So when they would build these big airplanes, they're like 777 jumbo jets. So like the biggest of the big intercontinental jetliners. Near the end of the build process, where they're putting these things together, there's always mistakes made. Like, people can't build a perfect product, but you also can't take the whole airplane apart to put a new part in. So our job was to look at the look at the damage that was caused to the airplane. And then we would design a repair step by step that has to go from an engineer that's looking at it from a technical aspect. But mechanics are building these things, and mechanics are geniuses, but they don't have the engineering knowledge that says, oh, I can't use all these fancy engineering words with them. I have to break it down to step by step, simplistic things that they can actually build the airplane with. And then they go do stuff that I could never even dream of doing. So it was like the mesh of assembly process and engineering, and that taught me technical writing to the point that if I didn't clarify my ideas in a step-by-step way, then they would never build the airplane right, and it would be a dangerous thing to fly on. So I kind of got lucky there, and then I transitioned it to teaching in another aspect.
Yeah. So you obviously went to university, did engineering, came out a fairly intelligent person.
Lucked out. Yeah.
No, I never went to university. I just bluffed my way to where I am today. But
Student of life.
Yeah. Well, yeah. My life's been pretty rose-colored. You know, it's pretty simple. Look, you describe yourself as a full-time wilderness photographer, and you know, so what is it about the wilderness that makes you want to go out there and immerse yourself in it?
Yeah, quiet and the forced solitude makes you clarify things in your mind that you wouldn't have to when you can busy yourself with other stuff. Like when you go on a backpacking trip for 10 days or 15 or 20 days, you have your camera gear, which can distract you some, and you have hiking, which can distract you some, but you have a lot of time that you're not doing anything besides just sitting with your own thoughts. And I think it's something that I never knew existed at first. And when you sit with your own thoughts out in the wilderness for enough days, you're like, oh man, there's all this stuff coming up that I would have just not even thought of before because I'm always busying myself with stuff back at home. Like when I get back into society or reality, I'm always busy with stuff. There's just so much fun stuff to do.
Yeah.
But the wilderness forces you to really clarify your thinking on what matters and clarify your direction on what you want to do. At least it does for me. And I really love that about it. It's also a great reset. Like if I'm questioning something I'm doing in life or things aren't working out, I go out on a long backpacking trip. When I come back, I'm like, oh, this is not a right move in my life, or this is the right move in my life, or at least so I think, right? And then it also forces you to really spend time studying the landscape in the light, because when you can just camp out in a spot for a week that you found that's really cool and you like, and maybe you're 20 or 30 miles from any road, you can't just leave, or you could, but you're going to stay there and spend some time studying how the light hits the landscape day after day. And I think it's really conducive of better photos because you have an idea of how that small place in the world works at the specific time of year under the specific conditions. And you can spend time walking around looking for compositions all day. And if you shoot there for a week, you'll probably get something if there's not clear skies every single day, you know? So it's just like a force that makes you work on photography and makes you clarify your thoughts. Those are the two main things that I get out of it.
But your compositions are amazing.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
We've checked out your stuff. I've just got to ask you, do they come to you or do you go searching out the compositions?
So as far as looking for compositions, I will usually set up like how my backpacking trips are scheduled. I don't really have a plan besides I want to get into a specific area. So I'll study some topo maps and say, hey, that looks like a cool place to get. Let me try to get there. It might be on trail, it might be off trail. But once I get there and I really like the spot, I'll try to stay there for at least 2 to 3 days and I'll have my base camp set up with my tent. And then I can just have like a day pack and I can go with my camera and just hike around the area. And I'll just take my camera in my hand without a tripod. And I'll just take like snapshots to eye up compositions during the day. And then when I get back before sunset or sunrise, I'll look through like the snapshots I took during the day and I'll kind of narrow them down to like one or two that I really like. And that's what I'll shoot for at least like one or two good light sessions. So that can help. And then just taking a lot of photos and over time, I mean, you guys know this, you've been in the game for a long time. Your eye slowly starts to see what works in specific scenarios and what doesn't work in specific scenarios. So eventually, I think composition just comes naturally, but at first it definitely doesn't come naturally. I think it's just the repetitive process of refinement that gets it there. Do you guys feel like that with composition for yourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. It's I always find it the hardest thing to teach. I mean, you've got your basics and your building blocks of composition, but to really get it to a point where it's instinctive, it just takes time, I think, to get your eye trained to seeing things. But look, I mean, saying that, you know, I always say, oh, yeah, composition's not you know, it's just something I feel, but I get it wrong all the time. I think everyone gets it wrong, you know.
Same.
And sometimes the composition you don't think is right is the one that is right. You get back and, you know, on the computer and go, oh, well, actually, that does work now. So that you know, so yeah, it's, I guess, composition is one thing, and then, you know, knowing, you know, yeah, well, obviously, there's you can recompose in regard to cropping and all that after the fact, you know. So, you, but yeah, it is a hard one to really to nail. Time in the field is what will
help for sure.
That. Dave, do you ever get that thing where you think you've focus stack quite a bit too? So I imagine you bracket. But do you ever get that thing where you know you get back to edit your shots and they're just rubbish, but they look amazing in the camera?
All the time, man. You know what's when you see it on the back of a small camera screen, I feel like the biggest thing that always gets me is it looks really good on the back of the camera screen because the light's good. But then there's like all these small distracting details that you can't see until it's on a computer screen, and that's what always gets me.
Yeah.
So I mean, if I get like 1 or 2% of my photos that are good a year, I'm pretty excited with it. And then it comes down to like the processing aspect. If I don't have to focus stack, I won't. I mean, I try to be as lazy about it as possible.
Yeah.
If there's like something right in the immediate, if you're shooting at like 14 mil or something, and there's immediate foreground and then mountains, then of course you have to. But if it's like on the fine line between shooting at like F8 and focus stacking or just shooting at F16, I'll shoot at F16 because I just don't want to deal with it when I get back home. The same thing for like bracketing. Well, it used to be that we had to do that, right? But now you can pretty much just expose to the right for the highlights. And if you have a decent dynamic range camera built in the last 5 years, especially like Sony or Nikon cameras, or I don't know, there's probably some other ones, but you can just double or triple process one file.
Yeah.
And you have everything. I was
lucky enough to use an IQ for phase one for a little while. And I was doing some editing with that, and we pulled out, we had a photo that we deliberately underexposed by some like 5 stops. It was literally black, and we pulled a recoverable shot. It was so amazing that I determined that exposure was no longer an issue with the phase one camera. You just have to get your focus right and push the button. It was that amazing that, you know, to get that much detail without noise and issues, being so underexposed, it was literally black. It was just amazing. Yeah, that eventually that'll be gone anyway. And I love the idea that we'll have cameras that will just be, that will be able to capture everything that our eye sees in one shot, and then it just comes down to your composition and the light that makes the difference.
The one thing that I've noticed is I've been teaching my students at like online for the last 3 years. If you, well, you guys probably know this, but if you push your histogram in the field, which is a sRGB histogram, so you don't really see like the wide gamut, the dynamic range, I just tell them to push it all the way up to the right. And if you do that, if, as long as you're shooting something that's fairly neutral, then you can darken it down post, and you'll get all your highlights, but you get all this dark detail that you can pull out in the shadows that wouldn't have existed if you didn't push your histogram all the way to the right. The other nice part is if you're shooting like a really bright red or yellow, I usually tell them to push it all the way to the right and then back like 2/3 of a stop. And then you're basically exposing to the right for the red channel, which the red channel can be hard to control, sunrise or sunset. So that usually pretty much nails it every time. And then on import into Lightroom, I just have it apply a -1 automatic import preset to the exposure. And it basically puts that photo back where it was in the field. But then I have all this really nice dark detail that I wouldn't have had if I just exposed correctly in the field. So that's the cool thing about digital now.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. I started on film way back when, and you've got little chance to get your exposures wrong. You know, if you're shooting slides in a transparency, it's crazy town.
Yeah.
Dave, I've noticed from a lot of your videos, and if you're not already a subscriber to Dave's YouTube channel, get over to YouTube and search for Dave Morrow. Because his stuff is amazing. But mate, I've noticed that in a lot of your videos, you're shooting on a D810.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still your preferred camera, or?
Yeah, I just upgraded to a Z7 just because of I wanted to start making like some hiking videos and like some high quality nature videos to mix with landscape photography. And the D810 just isn't great for video. So I wouldn't upgrade it to the Z7 except I wanted to shoot 4K, better video, and I wanted to reduce my backpacking weight and get me about 3 pounds reduction. Otherwise, I'd still shoot with the D810 or the 850, I think. The sensors are pretty comparable. Like once you hit D810 level sensor, you're set. It's not like you need a new camera every year or two. It's just the dynamic range is insane at that point. And that's a 6-year-old camera. So yeah, I shoot with Z7 now, but that's why.
Yeah, I was interested in watching one of your videos and you talk about your gear and you said you had a tripod, two lenses and your camera body. And that's kind of refreshing because we're all, I mean, a lot of photographers and I'm included, are gear whores. You know, we just love to have all the gear, you know, and I mean, I'm actually fairly pared back compared to some people, but you know, you can only carry so much gear when you're out there hiking, and you only really need a couple of lenses, and if they've got good, you know, if they're zooms and they've got a good range of you know, focal lengths, then you're set. But yeah, and I guess being in the wilderness, you probably need to travel much lighter than, you know, so you can't afford to carry all that gear unless you've got someone with you.
For sure. Yeah, the other nice thing that's with the high megapixel cameras now is my new setup, I have a 14 to 30 millimeter, so wide angle, and then I have a 24 to 200. I used to carry a 28 to 300, but the Z7 has like, I don't think it's like 8200 on the horizontal as far as pixel count. So you can basically just take a 200 millimeter shot, and once you get used to it, you can visualize what the actual crop you want is in that shot, and you crop it to 300. And you're basically still sitting at like 7,000 pixels on the horizontal. Yep. So you can carry way less lenses and still get the same resolution you would have with like a D810. Yeah. So that's one advantage of the higher megapixel count cameras. You can crop into whatever millimeter length you want.
So Dave, you know, I want to go back a little bit, mate, because we know about your work, but we want to know a bit more about you. So take us back to the early days.
No problem. So I grew up on the east coast of the United States in the Appalachian Mountains in Pennsylvania, out in the middle of nowhere, in a house that my mom and dad built. And they're hippies, so they wanted to live off the land and build their own solar house. Yeah. So I grew up in that environment, which ended up being really cool because I was out in the woods every day. And then went to high school, went to college, graduated college, and there were no jobs because it was 2009. And the financial crash had just happened here. So at that point, I said, well, let's see what I can find. And Boeing Aerospace was the only place hiring. So I went out there and I moved to the north of Seattle, about 45 minutes. And I've been out here ever since. But when I first got out there, I just saw the size of the mountains out here. I'd never seen anything like it. I mean, Washington State has the most glaciated mountains in the lower 48 United States. So just massive, massive mountains. So I was like, I'm going to go explore that. So I started to teach myself backpacking. And then I was like, well, it'd be fun to take some photos. So I got a crappy old DSLR and started to take pictures. And then slowly that mentality of all or nothing caught on. And then I was just done, right? I was just hooked on it and I couldn't stop doing it. And just been going after it, trying to improve my processes and everything ever since. And still got a lot of learning to do. And it's been a fun process. I just like the entire process of tormenting myself with not being happy with where I am, looking at my photos and being like, all right, let's get to this next thing or this next level up and see if I can push my photos there. And then I'm sure, as you guys probably know, once you get to where you used to think you wanted to go, where your photos were good, you're like, oh, those are crappy, so I'm going to try to make better photos. And then it's like an endless cycle.
And I think that's what you need to, have that passion and that drive to be good and to be successful. Because If you think your work's the best it's ever going to be, you're never going to progress. And I think if you speak to most photographers that are successful, they're never happy. They, you know, there's always got to be that better shot, that next, you know, next. I've got to spend more time there. I've got to work harder to get that shot, to get that quality that I want. And you know, it's interesting you talk about, you know, the cameras that we have are good enough now to do pretty much everything we want, and it's more about spending time on your creativity. That's important, as opposed to, you know, buying a new camera or the latest software that, you know, because we've pretty much got all the tools we need now to make beautiful images.
Mm. Absolutely.
Dave, can we just touch on your sense of adventure? You moved from the East Coast to the West Coast as a young person. Yeah. Do you think that might have been one of the catalysts?
I know when my adventure sense turned on, I read On the Road by Jack Kerouac when I was like 17 or 18. Have you guys ever read that book before?
No.
It was awesome. It's an awesome book. It was written in the late 1950s, I think, by this guy that was kind of a maniac, but he liked to travel, and that's why it's called On the Road. So it's just basically an off the top of his head writing about all his ventures traveling across the US. And I read that and I was like, I want to drive across the country on like a bunch of back roads and stuff like that and see what it's all about. So my brother and I started doing these cross country trips where we would just pick some spots in the middle of nowhere, drive to them and try to make it across the entire country. And then slowly that morphed into, well, we should start doing some hikes on these trips. And then that morphed into, well, we should go backpacking. And then that morphed into how far from civilization can we get? And it's like that the leveling up thing happened again, and that's kind of just where it took me. But yeah, On the Road by Jack Kerouac was kind of what tipped me in that direction when I was about 17 or 18 years old.
Yeah, the US is like the ultimate place to go if you want to do a road trip, and I've done three road trips through America now, and I would go back in a heartbeat. I still think it's my favorite place to photograph out of anywhere else in the world, because there's so much there. And yeah, America's just got it all. Depending on what you like, it's got everything. You know, if you got you got your wilderness, you got your urban spaces, you know, you've
desert.
It's just it's just an awesome place. Easy to get around. Yeah, huge. And everywhere you go, I mean, unlike Australia, I mean, we always talk about Australia, it's probably roughly the same size as America, but the whole middle of it is basically a desert where you will die, and there's no roads, there's nothing. it's like, okay, well, I'm not going out there. I mean, there are roads and tracks and stuff you can do, but, you know, it's just not like America where you can go into the middle of a country and there's still things there. There's you know, there's roads, there's, you know, ability to get to places. But, yeah, over our way, it's, you know, we've got 25 million people, I think, Carwin, in Australia.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
in the whole country. So imagine getting the population of America and whittling it down to 25 million and then spreading them out.
Yeah, that's wild to think about. Yeah, it's crazy. Like, like when you were traveling across the U.S., I'm sure you noticed this, but the population densities in the U.S. are just so, like, congregated to specific areas that once you get out in, like, the middle of America, out in the big mountain ranges, there's just nobody out there in a lot of places. And you're like, there's no cell phone service, there's nothing. And you can really have, even if you don't like to go backpacking, a great little adventure where you're shooting stuff every day just from day hikes or near the road that you're having so much fun with. It's definitely a cool environment to take your landscape photography into.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, you talked about creating an exit plan or escape plan so you can do photography full time. I'm just wondering if you could help us out with our own escape plans.
Yes.
You know, how's the
we're listening,
how do you do it? You just go, right, I'm just going to bite the bullet. Did you just pretty much put your balls on the line?
Well, I had 2 years of savings, and by 2 years I mean 2 years of cash that if I lived very frugally, which I still do, I just like to live frugally because I don't like to be in situations.
So that's a lifestyle choice now, is to live frugally.
I just do that. I mean, it like my business now does way better than my engineering job did, but it didn't at first. But I just like to live frugally because it's less to deal with. Like, you don't have the constant upkeep of new things. That's why I don't like new cameras. You got to learn them. You got to it takes like a month to get good at a new camera again. Once I like master the stuff or get really good at the tools that I have, I like to keep them for as long as possible or until they're holding me back. So that's like where the whole frugality thing comes from, is that I just buy the tools that I need to do the job. And once I get good at them, it takes too much time to relearn. So I hold that off as long as possible. So that was the first thing for the exit plan, is some savings. I mean, you could do it without it, but when you have no money, the problem is that it's so stressful that you're going to make decisions in your business that aren't good for the long term because you're looking for short-term money. And I didn't want to be in that position because like, you can just look at people that run businesses online and you can tell which ones are in it for the long term, trying to do something that they want to help people with or affect people with, mm-hmm. or the people that are in it for the short term because they need money. And I just wanted to be removed from that short term scenario. So that's why I saved up. But then I just made the leap because there'll never be a good time to do it. Mm-hmm. I gave my work 2 months notice and I said, let's go. Mm. If I can figure out how to build airplanes or figure out how to do anything else in my life and do it decently, if I give it my all to photography, there's no way I won't be able to figure out over the long term. I think if anybody was looking for advice on that, I think my advice would be to trust yourself, because people are very smart and can figure out so much stuff when they devote every mental cycle to doing those things. And I just don't think we ever really give ourselves the benefit of the doubt to think that we can do stuff like that. And if you do, it can completely change how you live your life.
Mm. Yeah. Fletch and I are both aviation nerds, probably more
nice.
Christian. But the Boeing 777, I actually have a Boeing 777 t-shirt. To my mind, that is one of the most beautiful planes to work on, and just incredibly complex, but just a big quad, you know. And well, it's not a quad, is it? The 777?
Two engines.
Yeah, yeah. Two engines. Yep.
Biggest ones they make.
Just shows you how much of a fan I am. But
it's all right.
But
he likes the sporty models, though. Carmen, he likes the flashy ones.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
The 47 has two engines on each side. The 777's like the Lamborghini.
Mm.
That thing is a sexy airplane.
Yeah.
But it literally...
Well, yes, those are little, little Citation. You know, that's kind of more my ride these days. But,
yeah,
you know.
That's why.
Dude, I like those a lot more to fly in myself. It's way more fun.
That's what...
Yeah. That's what you die a lot easier.
We've all got our own private jet, you know, stored somewhere as being successful photographers like we are. Carmen's got a couple, I think.
Yeah, that's...
Do you guys fly airplanes?
No, I did. I did pararagliding with my wife for about 5 years before we had kids. And then when the kids came along, we decided that one of us is going to die doing this. So we will give it up and maybe go back to it. But then I went into just general aviation and started flying Cessnas and stuff. But, just learning. And again, just became too expensive and too time consuming. And I found out that I actually enjoyed just being driven, flown around, as opposed to flying it myself. I've always been an aviation nerd. I was in the Air Force Cadets when I was a kid, and I wanted to be a pilot back then. But things happen, and you don't get that. Well, I don't think I was smart enough, and I don't think my eyes were good enough to be in the Air Force anyway. So, I would have ended up just, probably washing planes or cleaning out the toilets or something like that,
Washing planes.
Yeah.
Oh, what about you, Dave? Have you done any flying, mate?
No, I've never learned to fly. I mean, I've been up with my friends that fly, and I've flown for a little bit, but I surely can't take off or land. Yeah. And I surely can't fly in bad weather.
I guess the reason I'm asking, and like particularly with, the biggest stuff, like there are literally a million moving parts in a plane, possibly more. So you, as an aerospace engineer, have to know what each of those individual parts do, and none of those parts can fail. I think you can have a broken coffee machine on a Boeing 777, you're still allowed to fly with that. But so all of those parts have to come together and do their job and be safe.
Yeah.
Do you find that background helps your photography in that you're able to process a lot of different things at the same time?
That's a great question. Well, first off, I don't think there's any engineers in general that are any good that know about all the parts and how they work. So it kind of just gets like, you basically go into like a subgroup of the airplane and you get expertise on a specific part.
Yeah.
And the goal there is that if you have people that are working on a specific part of the airplane build instead of the whole thing, then they're going to be much better at that specific part. I think also that engineers might get a lot more credit than they deserve for being smarter than they are. I think a lot of engineers are just tinkerers, and then they also have the situation where they go to school and then they learn some stuff at school. And I mean, school's valuable, but being actually working on aircraft is way more valuable. And like working with mechanics is really valuable, because mechanics, like some engineers scoff at mechanics, they're like, they don't have a degree. Well, I don't think a degree really does much, because it's great for like learning the background aspects. But if you can't build an airplane, then you're not a great engineer. So those guys taught me as much as school about how to build aircraft. So when it's all coming together, like, you have to just be an expert at a small area and then be able to say, hey, I don't know this. I'm going to need help from other people, because if we want this airplane to fly for 30 years, we're going to have to like work together on that one. So I think engineers are good at breaking down, like the end of your question. They're good at managing systems and how those systems interplay together. But a lot of times they're not experts at all the different parts in the system. They just know how to analyze a system and then say, hey, by a system, I just mean like a step-by-step process, a bunch of parts coming together. They know how to analyze that and break it into pieces so they can say, well, I know how to do this, or I don't know how to do this, and I'll get help. So for photography, it's essentially a system that comes together as far as like the physics of how the camera work, the process of camera technique, photo editing, all that can be broken down to like the actual technical aspects, and it helps a whole lot for that. But I don't know if my mind's any smarter than anybody else's on how that stuff work. It might be, it might not be, but it, the engineering background definitely helped.
But if you look at some of the disciplines in, you know, the craft, if you like, and you, you know, you do focus stacking, and I mean, you're a master at Lightroom. Like I was watching your stuff the other night going, I didn't even know that. But do you find, you know, I guess what I'm getting at is it easier for you to pick up complex, you know, disciplines, if you like? I mean, because me, it took years. So
I would say probably. It's taking years, rather. I would say also that I just know how, I know how to learn extremely well. Like I know how my brain works as far as like putting knowledge together in a way that works. And I just build my life about around like, if it's not something creative, meaning I don't have to think of a new idea, anything that's like technique, I build systems with. Like, so when I take photos, I have a step-by-step, like I have a process that just goes in my subconscious now, but it used to be like, I have to think about it, right? But I do it in the same order every time, so I don't have to think about the right camera settings. It's just kind of working on composition and light and all that kind of stuff.
What's that, what's that process?
I would say that I probably pick up stuff quick just from learning how to learn. And then it's just experimenting a lot on my own in all different parts of my life and learning that you can fail a whole lot. Like lots of little micro failures will get you somewhere a lot faster than just sitting back and being afraid to fail and not after going after stuff. So I just constantly fail at stuff. And then I learn a whole lot from that failure process, which gets me to places that I want to go faster than just sitting on the sideline and being like, oh, well, I'm afraid to fail.
I love the fact that you, you know, devote so much of your time to photography without getting these distractions, you know, all these things that are pulling you away from the thick craft. And you know, this is the thing I'm struggling with at the moment is how do I keep focused on taking photos, because you know, there's so many distractions. You're having a gallery, you know, you got staff, you got, you know, you're wondering, well, you know, I've got to keep the social media going because people are relying on, you know, that's how they're finding me. But I think, you know, you're making, you've led me to sort of believe now that there is a life after social media. And then, and you know, if the website's good and then, you know, if you can work on a project that gets acknowledged in other ways, then maybe that's the way to go. But I think as all of us as photographers, we have a hard time just going, right, I'm going to make this particular photograph and then going out and doing it. It's like, it's so easy to go, yes, I want to do that, but then it's so hard to actually go out and make that happen. And I think, you know, what I'm getting from you is that you make it happen. You've got that. Maybe your business model is frees you up to do that so much more because it's mostly online, I'm assuming. But you do workshops, don't you? You take people on trips and stuff like that?
Yeah, I used to more than I do now. I do about like one or two a year.
Okay.
I never wanted to get like to the point where I was doing it and it felt like it was a chore because I didn't want to give it, just felt like it's hard to give people the best experience possible if it feels like a chore. Because even if you act like you're having fun, people can sense if you're actually like enjoying being there with them or not. So I do two or three of those a year, but other than that, online.
And that's it, that's that freedom. And we only got a sense of freedom, my wife and I, in our business when we had the COVID lockdowns, you know. I know in America it's been pretty hardcore with COVID, but over here in Australia we've had literally next to nothing. And whenever we've had some, we've been locked down really quickly and severely. Like it's like, right, that's it, you're not going anywhere, we're not doing anything.
But that is Western Australia. That's an important, you know, Western Australia, the Victoria's done it particularly hard.
And we were locked down for like 5 weeks in total to get rid of all our cases, and it worked pretty good.
Nice.
But I loved that. For me, that was like, wow, the gallery's shut. There's no one here. There's no one coming in. I mean, we survived on online sales, which was great.
Yeah.
And I was saying to my wife, God, this is great. Like, we don't even need a gallery. What if we could just get rid of all that distraction? I mean, I could go out and photograph every day of the week and not have to feel like I'm, you know, working on emails and you know, problem solving and going to the gallery and making sure everyone's okay. And yeah, so that sort of sense of freedom. And I'm assuming that's the sort of freedom you have with your business. You must feel like you wake up in the morning and you can concentrate, you know, everything on being creative and you know, doing great things on your website. So that's
been my goal, to set that up. I guess, like, in terms of the gallery, I'm just riffing on this. I have no idea how galleries work, but like, whenever I'm doing something in my business that I'm feeling like is taking away from my ability to do something else that I deem to be more important in the long term, I just say, well, how much money am I willing to lose to do it? Because sometimes, like, I lose a lot of money, not a lot, but like, I lose money not being on Facebook, I'm sure, because I lose people coming to my website. I lose money not being on my email every week, but the trade-off is worth it. So like, if I had a gallery, I might say, well, I might lose money if I don't have a gallery, but I'm also going to gain money because I don't have to pay for the gallery or spend my time there. So like, if there's a break-even point, I always try to find that. And I'm always just trying to refine that process, I guess. That's like my weird analytical engineering mind does that to everything. And sometimes it's not a good outcome. Like in relationships, it's not always a great thing, you know?
That's definitely much more complex subjects when we talk about other humans that you may or may not be having a relationship with. So, yeah.
I like to try to run experiments like that all the time. Like, if part of my business is, or part of stuff I'm doing, I'm not fully devoted to, I'll say, well, let's quit for 3 months and see how much of a hit, financial and hit you take, and how much better you feel mentally. And then you can say, well, let's say, just for example, let's say I lose $3,000. But then I'm like, oh, well, I feel so much better mentally, and I have this time to work on stuff that will produce way more in the long term for my business. So I'll be like, all right, see you $3,000. And I know everybody can't just make those calls depending on the point in your business you are, but I think, like, just knowing that that availability is there to cut stuff loose. I don't think it's taught to that many people for some reason. I didn't know it. I just, like, it took me some figuring out and thinking and reading and be like, oh, just cut some crap out of my life once in a while. It's hard to do, though.
What's the end goal, Dave?
My end goal is, that's a great question. I would say that my goal is to build a knowledge repository, being my online school, that teaches everything I know about outdoors, landscape photography, the image creation process, creativity, and like even this philosophy of just like creating and getting after it. I want to build something that will be there for the long term, that will help a lot of people learn and that can scale up, and that will show people different ways of living they might not think or know exist right now. And then I also just want to do a lot of backpacking, do a lot of photography, and hang out with people. Like, doing stuff like this is a blast for me. I mean, having the free time and the internet to do it is awesome. I love it. Pretty simple end goal.
You've got a whole new audience now in Australia because of, you know, we get a lot of Aussies, obviously, are our biggest customers to this podcast. When I say customers, they're not actually paying customers. They're listening.
But they can, so if they want. They can pay if they want to.
Just saying. We
you never know, hurts
every now and then, even a carrot cake delivered, you know, in a, you know, it's good, you know.
Can I ask you guys the same question? I mean, you guys have been in photography a lot longer. Do your what's the end goal, and how much has it shifted? Like, is it like, do you make a new end goal, or like, how's that work for you guys?
Well, Christian has been in it, you know, forever, so
I see, this is the thing. I don't know what my end goal is, or if there is an end goal.
Yeah.
And I'm so caught up in just the everyday running of the business that there is no end. It's like Groundhog Day every day, every week. And my wife just said to me this morning, she said, we need to have a meeting, you and I. We need to sit down because we are just going over the same things. We're saying we're going to do something. We never get around to doing it. We're so caught up. And we've got things like point of sale system. The mob that we use, Lightspeed, have just created this new point of sale system, which is completely changed from the old one, and it doesn't work for our business anymore. So all of a sudden it's like, well, this is not usable, you know? So they've just cut us out and said, well, the old one's gone. That's it. So now we're looking for a new point of sale system to make so we can sell pictures in the gallery and track all that stuff. And that, you know, that becomes a stress. And then it's something else, and then it's something else. And
it's
then,
not so hard,
you know,
mate.
You get asked to do something, or there's an event coming up, you have to, it's just never ending. And
but Fletch,
we don't have an end goal. It's like the end goal is probably, the only end goal I can think of is getting my kids through high school, funding that, and then Jen and I are saying, we're going to go away and do more traveling. We're going to jump in the car, and we're going to take a tent or a camper, and we're going to go off and just spend more time away taking photos. Mm. That is kind of an end goal. But then we haven't worked out how we're actually going to do that. It'll probably mean getting a manager into the gallery or you know, more help there. So, you know, you're paying more wages, which is fine. I don't mind paying more wages and getting staff. But then, you know, it's giving up that control as well, and knowing that it probably won't run as the same way that you would like it to run.
Yeah.
And you know, is that important? Do I need to keep that? You know, is my end goal to have a legacy, or do I just, I mean, I've been going for so long now that it almost seems hard to stop it, because I, you know, it's become a lifetime sort of thing and a life's work. I couldn't imagine just saying goodbye to it all and just disappearing into nothingness, you know? So, I mean, I'll always do photography, but there is no end goal. I can't find
raising kids is a solid end goal. I mean,
I don't
have any kids, but I respect the shit out of people that raise kids that become successful adults. Successful meaning like not success in terms of money or like what they did, but like they're having a good life, they're enjoying stuff, and they're working on stuff they care about, you know? That's if we can get more of those people doing that, that's pretty solid end goal in my opinion.
Do you know what I find ironic though is Christian, you know, I mean, raising kids is super important. So if you ever want them to, you know, sort of do the dishes or wash your car, you've got to have kids for those sort of roles. But isn't it interesting where your end goal is to go off with Jen and take photos in the wilderness for our US audience, and Dave's already doing that. So it's like you've already achieved your end goal.
I found like the life that I set up to be the most conducive of being able to provide different ways of thinking and doing things, which I can in turn teach back to people. I guess I saw an avenue where I guess there was like a lot of self-help stuff, and then there's like a lot of photography stuff, and then there's like all these different niches that where people were teaching or doing stuff. I wanted to combine it all together and say, hey, you can just make all these things part of your life and just go do stuff, like have an idea in your head and then have the guts to say, I'm going to go create that in real life and see what comes out of it. So I wanted to have free time that I could constantly have those ideas pop up and go create them and then teach people how to do that on their own. I guess that's my end goal. So I needed to set up an environment in which I could actually live that, or I'm kind of just teaching people a bunch of crap I don't actually do. And then I can't actually do a good job of teaching them if I don't actually do it in my real life.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think that's what I like about this, your words and that, and your blog, and the kind of, it seems authentic. And I think that's important. And, you know, I was sitting there watching a video. I said to Jen, this guy's pretty wise. I think he's got some great ideas, you know, and I think that's a good thing that you can pass on to photographers, because we're not all the same. We all have different goals and paths and ideas. But a lot of photographers, especially in the landscape genre, care about the environment, love to be out in it, you know, like to do more in it. It's just getting past the distractions of the everyday life that gets in the way, and you've seemed to be able to clarify that and simplify that to a point where, you know, you're living the dream, man. That's what it, you know, that's what it comes down to.
I mean, I try to just cut everything out.
You know, I mean, I don't know
for sure.
I don't know if you got out of date milk in your fridge, or you know, you eat baked beans for a you know, for
I eat cans of beans all the time.
I noticed in one of your films in the back of your car, you've got a bottle of whiskey stashed in the side pocket in the back of your truck.
Yeah, that's good calories, man.
Yeah,
would you, mate? Would you describe yourself as an environmentalist?
No, not at all. I would describe myself as somebody that wants to look at how things are actually working on the planet and take into account engineering and actual science, not just so-called science, and looking at things and actually questioning what's really going on. And unfortunately, a lot of people probably won't like to hear this, but the environmental movement has really good aspects in some ways, but it also gets hijacked by politics a lot of times, which causes people to make bad decisions that don't actually help the environment. An example of this is you can say, well, we want all green energy instantly. But if you don't use fossil fuels to slowly transition, and we don't really know where this transition is, there's no good science on it, but let's say you just shut off all fossil fuels right now and you go all green energy, you'll never get to where you need to go because all your economies will shut down and you won't be able to engineer the actual technology you need to get you out of the climate change issue. So unfortunately, a lot of environmental groups I've especially seen over the last 4 years have taken the political party line. But I think that whenever people get into the groupthink mentality, which unfortunately politics does, because we're tribal people and people get into these tribes of thinking, I think it can really muddy the waters on seeing a long-term actual effective solution that gets us out of the climate change problem. And I think we need really smart people to look at this clearly and to say, hey, we happen to have all of these tools such as fossil fuels, and fossil fuels are obviously what got us into the bad situation, but we also wouldn't be in this technological situation without fossil fuels. So they gave us a lot. And when we look at one thing and we just deem it that it's the devil, and we don't say, well, there's all these positives that we could use as tools to get us out of the current situation, then it's just not going to be good for anything. So as somebody that is hard into the analytical aspects of engineering and how the world actually works, I think it would be great if everybody just stepped back from the situation and their ideology and say, hey, maybe we're going to need to use some of these tools that actually cause carbon emissions to get us out of the problem. And we can slowly scale them back, but making them the enemy or the devil is not going to do that. And if you listen to somebody like Elon Musk talk, he's making the solutions to this problem, but he'll also say that we need fossil fuels to do it because we need lots of energy. He needs fossil fuels to power the Tesla plants. You can't do it without it yet. Once we can do it without it, then we can slowly start to dial it back. But when we make something the enemy, we can't have clear thinking on it because we're so angry at it. So that's my long answer to the environmentalist thing. I think we need to all take our own feelings out of it and look at it more clearly.
Can't we just power the earth with love?
Oh, yeah, all the time, man. Well, you know, it'd be nice if they'd turn some nuclear plants on. That's something we could actually power the earth with. Well, but
yeah, don't joke. Like, a lot of people, you know, are taking that very, very seriously as a, that's another discussion in itself.
Yeah.
So I guess, like, I'm sure there's some people listening to me say that and they're boiling mad. And all I would ask is that if it makes you angry, then you can't look at the situation clearly. And if you're getting mad at somebody saying something, then it's definitely time to step back and say, well, if I'm mad, I can't make the best decisions on this because nobody makes decisions in a good way when they're mad.
No, that's right. Hey, I'm going to change the subject, and
I have
a burning question, and I'm sure this is one that's, I'm sure you've had some experiences, but have you got a bear story or some animal story that's tried to kill you while you're out in the wilderness?
That is a great question.
There's a whole lot of stuff out there in America that will want to kill you. So how's that been? Have you
Man, this is... The interesting thing about wild animals is that there's a lot of fear around wild animals, but usually they want to stay the heck away from you. Now, grizzly bears can be pretty scary if they're hungry, but in where I live, in the mountains of the lower 48 in the United States, black bears, brown bears, cougars, if you make noise and don't sneak up on them and don't try to harm them or their cubs or their kids, then they're just going to stay away from you because they would rather eat something that's a lot easier to get a hold of. Now, if one of them is starving or like hurt, then they might attack you, but I've never had any bad circumstances.
That's interesting.
I also do something that everybody will, well, not everybody, but people won't like this either. I sleep with my food in my tent. Because now, if you're in grizzly territory, don't sleep with your food in your tent. Get it away from you. But everywhere else, food outside of your tent, somewhere near your tent, is going to attract more wild animals. Now, liability's on you. You can't come after me if you use this method and a wild animal comes after you. But keeping a clean camp and keeping stuff in scent-proof bags, I've never really had any problems.
Are you packing heat out there? Like, are you carrying a 9?
No, it's too heavy. I'm not against guns at all. All for firearms. Great way to protect yourself, but I just don't want to carry it out in the wild. And if one of those animals is coming after you, you have to have a pretty large caliber firearm to take it out. It's going to take like 5 pounds. I mean, it's going to be a lot of backpacking weight to carry with you.
Cameron and I think we'll stick to Australia because we've only got kangaroos and koala bears over here. And
drop bears.
They're pretty good. You know, we generally eat those on a regular basis. But
can I circle back to the environmentalist thing? What would you guys consider yourself? Like, you've watched this develop as far as the narrative over the last, I mean, your whole lives. I've only watched it develop. I'm 35. So I like to hear what other people think about how it's morphed and changed, because I don't know that much about it, you know? I've only been in this game for like 10 years doing landscape photography, and I'm definitely not always right. I just try to not get angry or mad when I think about stuff.
Yeah, look, I agree that there's definitely always two sides to the argument, and it does get heated and political. And, you know, my thing is that if you have a belief and you try to ram that down someone's throat, they're not going to come over to your side of the argument anyway.
Yes.
So, no. You know, people and you know, you touch on education and real, you know, real world solutions. You know, I think the best thing everyone can do is just try to live more sustainably themselves. I mean, that we don't have much control over the big corporations and what they do. They need to sort of, generally they'll only change with financial incentives, you know, if it's a good financial incentive or good reason to do that. But you know, if you can live at home and do things in your own little backyard in your own way, I think that's the best thing. And you know, live by example. If you have great concerns about the environment, then don't do things that are going to destroy it as much as possible. And you know, we try to do that in our family as much as we can. But you know, we're all hypocrites. We all, you know, I've traveled all over the world in jet planes, bloody done lots of miles. I mean, I always try to offset my emissions. You know, if there's the ability to pay with Qantas, you can pay for that. But yeah, it's a really hard topic. And you know, I have seen changes. Definitely, there's stuff going on. But look, I you know, what the solution is. The solution is that we all come together, agree on something that is going to happen, is going to work, and just work towards that. So
yeah, I agree.
I agree with you. If you make it something the devil, you're just going to, you know, upset one side of the argument, and they're going to come out swinging.
But
you don't win a fight by, you know, telling somebody that they're wrong and they're evil and they're stupid and all that sort of stuff. So,
but I think if you make a solution that is actually better alternative, like what Tesla is doing, that's how you actually make changes. You don't make it political. You say, hey, I'm going to offer you a better product that's cheaper, and that actually provides a long-term benefit to you, which in turn provides a long-term benefit to the environment. Like, there's an engineering solution for it, and it gets clouded up by a bunch of other stuff, which is not where we want to head. What were you saying, Carwin? Sorry.
Well, look, I reckon it's gotten too political, and it's you know, getting to the point where, you know, people are starting to feel environmental guilt, if you like. And it's interesting you touch on Elon. He produces electric cars, and you know, they need lithium. So where does the lithium end up in 10 years' time? Like, we've had to pull it out of the earth and then maybe put it back into the earth. So you've got to sort of keep that in mind. But is it cheaper than fossil fuel in the long run? I don't know. You know, maybe hydrogen is going to come to the fore. But the way I think about it is, and was it Peter Eastway that said this, or was it Tony Hewitt who said, you know, no matter what your opinion is about the climate or climate change, if you're a skeptic mm-hmm. or whatever you are, is it really going to hurt to do the right thing anyway? You know, like
I agree with that.
Recycle, you know, be as frugal as you can, not chuck bloody plastic in the bushes, you know, it can't
hurt.
That's
just a good mentality in general, I think, right?
Yeah, and most people probably would subscribe to that. You just get the 10% of knuckleheads that don't do the right thing, you know,
and yeah,
mess up. But also, it all comes down to your economies as well. And a lot of these people that are putting, countries that are putting a lot of the plastic into the oceans don't have the money to do what we can do. You know, they don't have garbage collectors coming around and hiding their shit in the, you know, the back box. I mean, over here, it's all, I mean, our societies function quite well and they're stable, but you know, you got these other countries where it's not so easy. You know, they haven't got the money to be environmentally friendly. It's just like, man, I got to get food on the table. So it's a big topic. But anyway,
yeah, it's clearly climate change is happening. Like I don't deny that at all. It's obviously the CO2 levels are through the roof right now. And other, like you were just saying, other countries, when you have things in your life that are survival needs, like what is it, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if you don't have food fulfilled and shelter and like a family that's loving, you don't care about climate change. So
that's very
there's
true.
No way we're going to get the globe to care about it unless we get more people out of that situation first. So I think like the sequencing might be wrong in blaming a bunch of people for doing stuff that don't have any money or food. You're saying, hey, you guys are jerks because you're wasting all this stuff. Well, the people can't eat.
They don't
have a house, and you're going to tell them they're jerks. So like you're saying, Carolyn, it's not going to be a good method to get at it. So I think the sequencing can be changed and we can actually address the solution. But I think that it needs to be looked at in a bit different way. Maybe I just don't know all the people that are working on it clearly, but from what I see, there's a lot of propaganda out there that seems to be driving us in the wrong direction.
Anyway, look, if Elon Musk is out there listening to this conversation right now, we'd all very happy with a Tesla of some description. I don't mind if it's an older one, Model S.
Or a solar roof, anything.
Fine. And I'm even a Roadster. Look, I'm happy for the new Roadster because I like to go fast. Hey, mate, it's been awesome chatting. Thank you for your time. Thanks for your inspiration and your beautiful photos. How can people find you?
They can go to my website, which is just Dave Morrow Photography, or you can just type Dave, DaveMorrow in Google, or you can type the same thing in YouTube and you'll find my YouTube channel. Yeah. And then I'll also leave you guys a link from my website that you can go and download some free courses and stuff that I have if you'd like to leave that. So people can check that out in the show notes or wherever else that might be. I really appreciate you guys having me. It's always fun to just hang out with people that are down to earth and also into at least one thing that we're into is photography. So it's been a real pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me on.
We're light-minded, aren't we?
Yes.
Hence the name of the podcast.
I like it.
Light.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
appreciate
Dave.
It. Thanks, Dave.